I don't know what your timekeeping is like. Mine is immaculate. It's just all the other people that hold me up. My wife's not in the room, so I think I can get away with this. So I was going to tell you a story about timekeeping in our house, but I just sensed the leading of the Spirit not to do that now. You know that whatever context we find ourselves in, if you're somebody that likes to be on time and you like to get things done and you like to get out of the house in order to get to church at the right time, whatever it might be, and you've got somebody else who is a lot more relaxed about timekeeping than you are, that can often cause tension. So I'm led to believe. All right? Now, the amount of people, thank you both, that have rows on a Sunday morning in terms of getting on time for church is incredible, I gather. But I wouldn't know anything about that at all. But I don't know what your timekeeping is like. When you're on a schedule, you're eager to get stuff done and sorted, and someone else is a lot more relaxed. I wish I was a lot more relaxed about timekeeping. It really annoys me if I'm late for something or if I'm in a rush. That doesn't stop me seeming to be an expert at it, but it does really, really annoy me. And there's something about timing going on in this passage here. You see, the passage marks a really decisive point in the narrative of Jesus. We're in the Christian season of Lent, so we're leading up to Palm Sunday, which is next Sunday, and then we'll follow Jesus, as it were, through the events of Holy Week, marking the horror of Good Friday, and then celebrating the wonder of Resurrection Sunday. And we're now in the part of the journey that the passages set for us give, where Jesus has now very definitively made the kind of final turn towards Jerusalem. And he heads then to Bethany, just outside Jerusalem, which is a kind of staging post before, as a lot of you will remember, he goes down the Mount of Olives into Jerusalem for what we understand as Holy Week. And Lazarus is sick. And so his sisters, Mary and Martha, send word to Jesus that Lazarus was ill. And we know from the text that Jesus has got something of a fairly close relationship with this family. So news that Lazarus was seriously ill would have meant something to him. Okay? Verse 5, we hear that Jesus loved Martha and loved her sister Mary and loved Lazarus. So there's a particular relationship that they have. So it would have caused Jesus pain and anguish to hear that his friend Lazarus was seriously ill. He's not just a random person in a crowd. Not just somebody on the side of the street that he comes across. Not somebody like the woman at the well or the blind man that we heard about last week. Jesus has got a close connection with Lazarus. Yet this doesn't affect his schedule or his timekeeping or his immediate response. Jesus remains where he is for two more days. He's heard one of his best friends is ill. He stops where he is and then decides to head to Bethany. Now, Martha and Mary, when they send messages to Jesus, they don't explicitly say, Jesus, please come and make Lazarus better. But we see verse 21, verse 32, if you're following, that the woman desperately hoped that Jesus would come to them. Lord, if you'd only come, maybe you would have saved him. There's a poignancy, a regret in their words. Because they know that Jesus has the power to heal and restore. But no, Jesus waits just a little longer. I used to work with, we had a gap year student when I was in Burnley. And we had this little Colombian guy, he's about 4'8". And a delightful, most charismatic guy that you've ever met. He could charm his way out of any situation. Just a flash of his smile, and whatever mess he left behind, you couldn't help but, you know, sort of a heart would go out to him. Lovely lad called Emerson, and a great guy, loved the Lord, great servant of the Lord, and he came to us to do a couple of years youth work and outreach with us. Now, I was the person working mainly with Emerson, and I was his commentary, his boss. And look, every Wednesday for 7 years, virtually every Wednesday in term time, for 7 years of my appointment in Burnley, I would take assembly at the Methodist Church Primary School on a morning, Wednesday morning, 10 past 10, all right? It never once changed time. It was always 10 past 10, all right? And Emerson, he would forever turn up to lead said assembly at about 17 minutes past 10, all right? And I used to say to him, Emerson, look, it's at 10 past 10. Do you understand? He said, yes, Pastor Gareth. Yes, Pastor Gareth. No problem, Pastor Gareth. All right. Next week, 10:17, 10:18. We're halfway through the assembly. Emerson! Emerson! You were meant to be doing the assembly, and you weren't even here. And he would say, yes, 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 Pastor. Yes, Pastor. No problem. So I said to him, Emerson, the assembly's moved until now it's at 10 o'clock. That was a lie. But I had my fingers crossed, so that makes it all right, doesn't it? But, Emerson, it's now moved to 10 o'clock, all right? It was even later. 10:28, he kind of wondered, we'd finished. And he'd say, what did you do for assembly, Pastor Gareth? Well, I just made up one on the spot because you didn't turn up to do it. And anyway, and he'd flash his smile at me, and I'd think, oh, anyway, poor lad. Anyway, but of course, what would happen is, he used to live at the end of the village, and the school was in the middle of the village, and he'd set off. Actually, I'll give him credit, I think most of the time he probably set off in good time. It's just that he would wander up through the village, and if I was wandering up through the village, I'd see a church person, and I'd quickly pull my hood up and cross over the other side and get away as quick as possible. But he would see anybody, and he would stop and talk to them. How are you? How's your mother? How's your son? How's your cat? How's your, you know, blah, 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 blah. And then usually, to give him credit, he would stop and he would have a conversation and he would share something of his faith with that person. And he wouldn't stop until he was satisfied that he'd done enough. Then he would move on. And if it was me, I'd look at my watch, think, oh, I really need to run now. And he would look at his watch and think, okay, well, I'll be there when I'm there. God knows. And he'd meet somebody else. And he'd do exactly the same. How's your mum? How's your dad? How's your great uncle Walter in Australia? You know, blah, 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 blah. And he used to say, it's often said of Africans, but he used to say it. He used to say, Pastor Gareth, you have a watch, I have the time. That's what he used to say to me. Pastor Gareth, you have a watch, I have the time. Yeah, not the right time, but but you get the essence. You see, if I was Mary and Martha, I would be livid with Jesus. Your friend's sick. It's my brother. What are you doing hanging around for a couple more days? What is the matter with you? Will you move, Jesus? And I don't know why Jesus waits where he waits. It might be something possibly to do with the fact that in Jewish custom, a person wasn't completely pronounced dead unless they'd remained so for 3 days. And there was a common belief that the spirit of the dead person remained around the body for 3 days, trying to get back in and wake them up. And after 3 days, it was thought impossible for that to happen. So therefore, they were thoroughly dead. That might have been what Jesus is thinking. If so, there is significance in his arrival 4 days after Lazarus has died. But the community would have been well assured that in no uncertain terms, Lazarus was thoroughly dead then. And that extra time might have been crucial in their understanding about what was to happen. Perhaps Jesus wanted the crowd to know that this was no waking up from a deep sleep. This was the raising of the dead. But whether that is it or not, the important thing is this. Jesus is entirely in step with God's perfect timing. And often that timing won't entirely chime with ours. And we know that, don't we? Any of us that have poured our hearts out in prayer and have wrestled for God to act, and it seems to take an eternity, for anything like a response that we'd imagined to occur. So often we want God's answer now or God's action now, when actually God is waiting, maybe even pausing, because he's got a greater work to accomplish that we've not yet had insight into. Maybe there's something here for us about control and power. Jesus doesn't respond to the whim of even the people he knows intimately. He won't be controlled by them. He won't be manipulated by them. He won't be ushered along by them. His timing, God's timing, is what drives, well, it doesn't drive him, is what he's settled in. And so maybe there's something then for us about being more trustful and reliant on God, even when God seems slow to act. Jesus walks in step with God's will and purposes. His ways will often seem very much unlike ours, yet he knows exactly what he is doing. And so is there something for us of trusting God, of trusting Jesus, when his timing doesn't quite match with ours? Secondly, this passage tells us that Jesus knows what pain is all about. When he arrives at Bethany, he cannot be unaffected by what he finds. And the whole community is in mourning, and there is much weeping and sharing of grief. And when Jesus encounters Mary and Martha, who he cares for so much, and when he sees the sadness of the village, he's not passive, he's not unmoved, he's not unaffected. The text says he was moved deeply in spirit and troubled. And that's a curious phrase, really. In the original text, it really reads, Jesus was agitated, Jesus was angry. So Jesus is angry that Lazarus is dead. He is frustrating and he is despairing at the futility of death and the pain that it causes. And that phrase that we translate deeply moved literally means to cry out in anger and frustration at what Jesus has come across. And that is what Jesus does, so it seems. Cries out in annoyance, cries out in despair that his friend has died. It's as though Jesus is saying, Lazarus is dead. Look at all these people weeping and retching with pain. No, God, no! And I guess so many of us have been in that exact place. Whether it's over bereavement, whether it's over circumstances that seem to be going the opposite of how we would have wanted them to be, whether it's over a redundancy that we wish would just never come. And if you didn't know this already, hear this. Jesus is not unmoved by sadness and pain. He feels it. He feels it. So if you're carrying grief and sadness and pain or regret, there is one who shoulders that burden, shoulders the emotional toll and weight with you. Jesus understands. He weeps with you, and he shares your trouble. He is not some robotic stone statue in the sky, but the God who has worn and inhabited our flesh, shared our emotions, and therefore knows the joys of life, yes, but also the pain and the desolation of sadness and of grief. So if you are struggling at the moment, if you are grieving, if you're exhausted, if you're worn out or at the point of giving up entirely, Jesus understands. He is moved to compassion. He cares. See, in one of the most poignant verses in the entire canon of Scripture contains just two words: Jesus wept. Jesus wept. Tells us that Jesus weeps for Lazarus. Tears of sorrow. Tears of regret, maybe. Tears of love. Tears of compassion for Martha and Mary. Jesus understands the reality of pain and sadness. He suffers with us then and suffers alongside us. He understands. He cares. He carries us. And so when we come to him crying out with despair or crying out in anger or frustration or crying out just with the sheer raw grief and pain, he gets it. He knows it. And he is moved by it. You know, if I had a penny, I was going to say a pound, but I'll even go for a penny. For every time somebody said to me, when something bad has happened to them, oh, I just can't come to church because I'll cry all morning, I'd be a wealthy man. Yet this is the place, folks, where we should be able to cry our eyes out and it be completely all right. Because we're among friends, but two, because we're ultimately in the presence and with, alongside one who weeps with us, holds us, cares for us, loves us, gave himself for us. Jesus gets it, and he carries you when you're weak. And then, having said all of that, there comes this quite incredible demonstration of God's power. In John's Gospel, what you get is Jesus making a number of statements that begin with, I am. I'm the way, the truth, and the life. I am the gate for the sheep. I am the good shepherd. I'm the bread of life, the true vine, blah, 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 blah. And usually what you get with those statements is a sign that goes with that. And here it's the other way around. Jesus says to Martha, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live, even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. And this was the seventh of those statements. And the number seven was of great significance in Jewish thought. It signified completion, fullness, fulfillment. It's as though all the signs and sayings of Jesus have been pointing in John's writing to this. It's as though Jesus is saying, I am the Lord, even over death, the final thing that can't be beaten. I have beaten it. And this fact that even death cannot contain or quash God's power is the only source of hope that we have. In a couple of weeks' time, we will be celebrating Easter Sunday. We'll remember once again the tragic events of Good Friday, yes, when we recall Jesus strung out on the cross for you and for me. And for everyone who's ever lived, for that matter. Thoroughly dead. And then on Easter Sunday, we celebrate again Resurrection Day. Jesus is alive by God's power. He is raised from the dead. Death cannot hold him or tie him down. It is the ultimate vindication of all that he has said and done to this point. And the text which we're looking at today clearly is foreshadowing that event. It points forward to what is to come. That Lazarus, who is dead, is alive. Jesus, who will be crucified and was dead, is raised again to triumphant life. And so Jesus orders the stone to be rolled away. And they're all worried that it's going to smell to high heaven. Smell like my office after I've left three coffee cups in there for a week. Or worse, if possible. And Jesus says, Lazarus, come out! And I would just have loved to have been there. Mainly to see the look on their faces. As out, perhaps, you know, remember Lazarus is bound up. Verse 44, Jesus says, untie him. So he's all bound up from head to toe. He's like a, you know, one of those mummies that when you're doing sort of kids' holiday clubs, you wrap the person in toilet roll right from head to toe. And Lazarus kind of waddles out of the tomb. You know, if it was me, I'd want to go, I'm alive, jazz hands. But he can't do that. He's bound up. At one word of Jesus, Lazarus, three words, Lazarus, come out. Even the dead are raised to life. This man, Jesus, is one in whom people find incredible transformation. Whether it's the woman at the well a few weeks ago, estranged and excluded, welcomed into community. Whether it's the blind man that we looked at last week who could not see and has his eyes opened. Whether it's Lazarus and his family. This is the great man of transformation. This Jesus changes everything. And he changes Lazarus's life. This man, Jesus, is the most magnetic and incredible person in human history. He does works of great power, as well as having a heart of great compassion. And we see those two combined beautifully in this text. And you know, there are few people that cannot find a relating point to this Jesus, the most dynamic figure of human history. He said, I'm the bread of life so that bakers can understand. So I'm the water of life so that plumbers can understand. So I'm the resurrection and the life so that funeral directors could understand. So I'm the good shepherd, so that farmers could understand. I'm the gate, so that gardeners could understand. So I'm the vine, so that drinkers could understand. I'm the truth, so that politicians could understand. I'm the way, so that ramblers could understand. I am the life, so that you and I could understand. Jesus said, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live even though they die, and whoever lives by believing in me will never die. And then what does he say to Martha? He says, do you believe this, Martha? I'm telling you who I am. I'm telling you with a great hint of what I'm about to do. But Martha, you know, you're my best friend. We're buddies. But Martha, do you believe this? Do you believe this? And so I ask you the same question. Confronted with a Jesus whose timing is perfect as he walks in step with God's will. Confronted with a Jesus who weeps when we are at our weakest point, who holds us when we are frightened, nervous, and wrung out completely, and understands it completely, who transforms everything, even brings the dead to life. Do you believe this? Do you believe this? Is this Jesus who he said he was? The Lord of all life? And if he is, that means something wonderful and exciting, or something terrifying.